Welcome to History 101, Lecture 22, Science, Unbelief and Religion. If we think about religion in the Victorian age, there are two possible images, and both of them are true. On the one hand, there is the idea of the Victorian age as the great age of faith, something many a Protestant pastor still longs to return to. It was an age when all classes were bound together by brotherly sympathy. In those merry days of old, churches and chapels were supposedly crowded with worshippers, and it was a great age of church building too. Indeed, it was the great age of church building. The skylines of most European cities are still dominated by the spires of all the churches erected in the age, in a kind of omnibus neo-Gothic style, so that these mass-produced churches are mostly as interchangeable as factory buildings. And too, they were erected in the colonial projections of Europe. The Anglican cathedral on the picture, for example, could just as well be located in England, but it is actually located in that most Victorian of Australian cities, Adelaide. The Victorian order rested on three pillars. First, there was the happy, closely tied family, which, in an age in which it was generally taken for granted that, as one said at the time, the sensual side of human nature is the lower side, and as such it should be repressed, still provided an escape for tender passions. It revolved around parental love, marital bliss, and Bible study. The Christian home supposedly came down directly from Eden to safeguard purity and peace, and it was supposed to be modeled on the relationship between Joseph, Mary, and Jesus. Second, the motto of the age was, "Heaven helps him who helps himself." Hard work and self-reliance, inspired by the fear of the Lord, would allow even the humblest worker to ascend to riches. The great bestseller of the age was Samuel Smiles' book, Self-Help. This is the granddaddy of all those self-help books that argue that if you but work punctuously, obediently and hard, and if you go to church every Sunday, you will surely ultimately be rewarded with riches, the kind of books that are, hardly coincidentally, still being sold by the millions in third world countries. And thirdly, there is the image of the Victorian age as one of the most intensely Christian societies the world has ever seen. Christian ideas and artifacts pervaded everything. Every family possessed a family Bible, rich family several. The walls were decorated with crucifixes, and the best-selling book, even overtaking Smiles, was Hymns, Ancient and Modern. Religious tracts were printed by the millions. Those of the Methodists alone sold 1.2 million copies, so we may safely assume most families in Victorian Britain possessed, and probably even read, religious tracts. It was rather a big change from the religiously rather indifferent society of the mid-18th century, when the baser sort of people were considered to be mainly interested in drink, and the English elite mainly in gambling. That was the kind of society still pictured in Dickens' Requiem on Merry Old England, the Pickwick Papers in the 1820s, where Mr. Pickwick, if he has any idea of religion at all, mainly ridicules it. The general perception in the mid-18th century was that organized religion was in decline, as it was eroded by skepticism and indifference. Yet, partly, the French Revolution taught the British elites they better pay close attention to matters of the faith if they did not want to imperil that social order of which they were the chief beneficiaries, lest they shared the fate of the French aristocracy, who had been similarly indifferent to religion. The most telling example of that is perhaps Napoleon's foreign minister and former bishop of Autun, Charles Maurice de Talleyrand, who was more or less pitchforked into the bishop office by his family and happily went on womanizing all his life, whether he was a bishop or not. And he enthusiastically participated in the persecutions of priests during the Revolution. Talleyrand saw all religion as but a charade, just like his master Napoleon. His appreciation of religion being apparent from his view on the USA, where there were, Talleyrand said, 27 churches and one course at dinner, and that one course bed, although likely many Europeans, and assuredly all Frenchmen, would still agree with that. Partly too, England experienced in the late 18th century a religious revival, in which people turned away from the established church, not merely as it was corrupt and inefficient, but simply as it was the establishment church, a revival that is particularly linked to the movement headed by preacher John Wesley, whose group, as they were derided by the fellow students in his study days, due to their systematic observance of the faith, were called the Methodist, a term that Wesley then took as a complementary name for his movement. Wesley felt, with good reasons, that the church had failed to call all those upper or lower class sinners to repentance, and that many of the clergy were corrupt and people perishing in sin. And he believed he was commissioned by the Lord to bring about a revival of the church. No opposition, no persecution, no obstacles would ever prevail against the divine urgency of this commission. Wesley taught sanctification was obtainable after justification by faith, between justification and death. A Christian should live with a primary guarding regard for others and for their welfare. So that, on the one hand, Wesley preached, it was man's greatest duty to observe, as he wrote, that most important ruling of Christian wisdom, gain as much as you can gain, something which obviously particularly appealed to the rising industrial bourgeoisie. Yet on the other hand, he emphasized Christian brotherly love, and the Methodist Church was not organized in the rigid, hierarchic way of the Anglican Church, with its seats for the rich in the front of the church and the poor who had to stand at the back, while the Methodists looked after the poor too, sometimes providing funds for them to put up their own businesses, and surely distributed masses of greatest devotional literature amongst them, so that, to follow historian Edward Thompson, to the disinherited workers, this new church, with its doors always open, could offer at least some kind of community to relate to, as the older communities in rural England were all destroyed by the enclosures. It offered people a place, some place, in a hostile world. Yet while, to further follow Thompson, within the Methodist churches, the services were the kind of drama of confessions, the repentant backsliders or lost sheep brought back into the flock that most modern televangelists revel in, it was also an intermittent drama. Within the workaday, everyday practice of the congregation, energies and emotions, which might be dangerous to the social order, or merely deemed unproductive, such as the sexual drive, were only to be released in confessions during the service. While the working class members of the Methodist congregation were taught to bear their cross patiently and always display the kind of sober, obedient, and industrious behavior Smiles prescribed to, lest they be threatened by the fires of hell, we have used the Bible as if it were a constable's handbook, Charles Kingsley wrote in his book Politics for the People in 1844. We have used the Bible as an opium dose for keeping beasts of burden happy while they are being overloaded. It is a book to keep the poor in order. The first phrase was famously borrowed by Karl Marx. Later on, though he inverted it, saying religion was the opiate of the masses. However, though the British ruling class argued so themselves, and though Wesley said, the greater the share a people have in government, the less liberty, religious or civic, a nation shall enjoy, so he resolutely opposed any extension of the franchise, I should immediately rush to add that working class organizations of the 19th century were partly built around the Methodist Church, and so, as I said already, was the early Labour Party. Indeed, argued historian Harold Perkins, sectarian religion was to an extent the midwife of class consciousness in England. It allowed working class people to think beyond the confines of an established Anglican religion that was dominated by the gentry. In the early 19th century, those evangelicals did not so much effect a takeover of the Church of England as rather one of England, imbuing it with their own values and thus creating Victorianism. To illustrate the increasing religiosity of British elites, it is extremely hard to find out what religious views, if any, the two 18th century prime ministers William Pitt the Older and the Younger held. They appear to have been simply uninterested in it, as indeed still was the most venerable soldier and statesman of the early 19th century, the Duke of Wellington, who appears to have attended church more or less as a matter of decorum, rather than out of any deep religious conviction. Yet the towering statesman of the mid-Victorian period, William Gladstone's life, was entirely shaped by religious conviction. Indeed, thought Gladstone, it was the duty of politicians to look upon the principles established by God as the only source for the well-being of nations. As his biographer Philip Magnus points out, he sought to mold himself, his country, and the world according to the principles of his personal religion, in which he believed with the simplicity of a child, not something one could even remotely say of the Pitts, or indeed of Wellington. All sorts of Christianity was imbued by the public schools, who had to imbue, as it was called at the time, a muscular Christianity, marked, as it was further defined, by the promotion of physical strength, the importance of family life and married love, a sense of duty and service to mankind by constantly expanding the borders of the British Empire, after all, supposedly the greatest agency for good in human history, and the study of the natural world, to discover divine patterns of creation. All this was taught at that most peculiarly British institution, the public school, or what beyond England is called a boarding school, and perhaps most familiar nowadays from the wizardly school of the Harry Potter novels, though I'm one of the few denizens of planet Earth not to have read them. The most elite ones, Rugby, Harrow, Eton, as they charged a fortune to attend, yearly more than English labourers might own in a lifetime, were the true breeding grounds of the English elite in the 19th, or indeed in the 20th century. Since, as I said before, they raised a kind of common fraternity feeling between the new industrial bourgeoisie, rich enough to pay to attend such a boarding school, and the old ruling classes, the landed gentry. The spirit of muscular Christianity was, for example, epitomized by that quintessential Victorian hero, General George Cory, who was everywhere carrying his thick Bible along and engaged in relentless Bible study every day. Yet, argued Lytton Strachey in his classic assessment of the muscular Christianity, Cordon was also an English gentleman, an officer, a man of energy and action, with a love of danger and of the audacities that defeat danger. Gordon was a passionate creature, flowing over with the self-assertiveness of independent judgment and the arbitrary temper of command. So, whatever he might find in his Bible, it was sure not for such as he to dream out his days in devout obscurity. But, conveniently enough, he found nothing in his pocket Bible indicating that he should. What he did find was that the will of God was inscrutable and absolute, that it was man's duty to follow where God's hand led, and if God's hand led towards violent excitements and extraordinary vicissitudes, that it was not only futile, but impious to turn another way. So that Gordon in his times, between all his Bible studies, acted as what we might nowadays call a mercenary counterinsurgency expert, first engaged by the government of China to fight the Taiping rebels in the 50s, and later on by that of Egypt, in order to quell an uprising that had erupted in the Sudan province and that was led by one obscure mullah, Muhammad Akmal, who pleaded that, quote, "Great was the wickedness of the people, and greater was their punishment. Surely their miseries were a visible sign of the wrath of the Lord. The people had sinned, and the cruel tax gatherers had come amongst them, corrupt governors, and oppression by the Egyptians. Yet these things should have an end. The Lord would raise up his chosen deliverer. The hearts of the people would be purified and their enemies laid low. Let the faithful take heart and make ready." Mullah Ahmad established himself at the island of Al-Ubaid, and he established an Islamic state there, where, or so the headlines in the British papers ran, the faithful, on the pain of severe punishment, were to return to the ascetic simplicity of ancient times. A criminal code was drawn, meting out executions, mutilations, and floggings with barbaric zeal. Before long, flogging grew to be so everyday an incident that the young men made a game of it, as a test of their endurance of pain. Urged upon by the British to stem all those horrors of the new Islamic state, the Egyptians sent army after army in to destroy Muhammad Ahmad, and they all melt away, as most soldiers sided with his new Islamic state, for they saw the government of Egypt as little more than a bunch of English puppets. So the British-Egyptian viceroy, Evelyn Baring, finally called on his old counterinsurgency expert Gordon to quell that uprising. Traveling to Khartoum, Gordon found himself surrounded by the army of the Islamic State and was speared on 25 January 1885. Mullah Ahmad then established a new Islamic caliphate in Khartoum and wrote letters to the Islamic heads of state and for that matter to Queen Victoria to return to the righteous way of Islam or face the consequences. Throughout England then resounded the cry to avenge Gordon, so that after much dallying, in 1898, the government finally sent out an army under Field Marshal Horatio Kitchener to revenge Gordon. And to quote Stacy, the future lay with Kitchener's Maxim Nordenfeld machine gun. 13 years after his death, Gordon was avenged, and the empire of the Mahdi was abolished forever in a gigantic hecatomb, after which it was thought proper that a religious ceremony in honor of General Gordon should be held at the palace at Khartoum. The service was conducted by 4 chaplains of the Catholic, Anglican, Presbyterian, and Methodist persuasions, and they concluded with the performance of "Abide with Me," the general's favorite hymn, by a select company of Sudanese buglers. Everyone agreed that General Gordon had been avenged. It had all ended very happily, in a glorious slaughter of 20,000 Arabs, a fast addition to the British Empire, and to step in the period for Sir Evelyn Baring. Rudyard Kipling afterwards honored those Islamic fanatics, as the British press commonly called them, or the Fuzzy Wuzzies, as the British Tommies called them, with his famous poem in London Cockney, which I shall not imitate, so that I read it in common English. He's got no papers of his own. He's got no medals or rewards. So he must certify the skill he's shown in using his long two-handed sword. When he's opposing in and out among the bush, with his coffin-added shield and shovel spear, a happy day with Fuzzy on the run will last a healthy Tommy for a year. So here's to you, Fuzzy Wuzzy, and your friends, which are no more. If we hadn't lost some messmate, we would help you deplore, but give and take the gospel, and we'll call the bargain fair. Though the British Empire always officially proclaimed it was neutral in religious matters, there was far more of a streak of militant Christianity to it, and indeed a crusading spirit to it, than it was officially ever willing to recognize, for otherwise it might alienate its 80 million Muslim subjects. For, as it was said in the 1850s, while it was a grand thought for any Englishman that the sun never set on Queen Victoria's vast dominions, it was an even grander thought. England's name was now worldwide associated with freedom, humanity, justice, and above all, that England stood first in spreading the benefits of Christian civilization to those nations less favored than she was. So the elite's Victorian muscular Christianity, Christian family values, and close reading of the Bible were projected abroad, and were intended to be projected abroad, as the public schools were the training ground for colonial administrators. And furthermore, as Wesley had preached, I look upon all the world as my parish. Whatever part of it I'm in, I judge it my bounden duty to declare unto all the glad tidings of salvation. So, as historian Kenneth Latourette rightly wrote in his multi-volume history of the global expansion of Christianity 50 years ago, nothing to equal the 19th century's dissemination of Christianity had been seen in the entire history of the Christian faith. Indeed, nothing remotely resembling it could be recorded for any other religion at any other time, and it would not have occurred had the faith not displayed inward vitality, and it was predominantly the Protestant era of the dissemination of Christianity. And that was, I venture to say, though most specialists on the mission in the 19th century would disagree, primarily because a very Protestant British Empire stood behind it. To be sure, there was a Catholic French Empire as well, but partly because of the metropolitan policy of laïcité, the French were more reluctant encouraging missionary endeavors than the British were. So, if you are looking for a society that is still, indeed, very much cast in the Victorian mold, regular church-going and intact happy families, the place to go to is not England. Rather, you should go to that most staunchly Protestant Caribbean island of Barbados, where, unlike in most islands, the slave population was already converted in the 17th century, and where the life of the entire island still revolves around the church. Elsewhere in the Caribbean, the conversion of the former slaves really only took off after their emancipation, for the slave masters had previously argued with His Majesty's Board of Commissioners for Trade and Plantations in the 17th century that, to quote, in order that they may be made Christian, it would be necessary to teach the slaves things English, and that would merely give them an opportunity to combine against their masters. And the opposite way around, one reason why the dissident Protestant churches had widely supported the cause for abolition of slavery was as slavery bred heathendom amongst slaves. The first missionaries were sent by the Methodist, Baptist and Moravian dissident churches in the late 18th century, against bitter opposition of the established Anglican Church, both as it held slaves and as the anti-slavery views of Wesley were only too well known in the Caribbean. Yet the missionaries began to score successes only in the early 19th century. For, if on the one hand the white missionaries surely preached, exactly as the clergy in the U.S. South did, that it was, quote, the duty of the lower classes to duly discharge their duties and disrupt any principle of insubordination, on the other hand, the missionaries assumed the slaves and the ex-slaves were no non-persons, but were capable of fulfilling roles in and to participate as free citizens in the church. Despite them being black and poor, they were still considered men and brothers, as the Methodists always said. Aside from which, the only education in the Caribbean in the 19th century was missionary education, and the slaves attended that with a degree of eagerness, and indeed with intellectual accomplishments, which astonished the missionaries, so that by 1840, most humdrum services in the church, deacons, chapel servants, and so on, were done by blacks. Yet, as one missionary wrote, if a white parson preached to them, the ex-slaves at best admired it as a proof of oratorial ingenuity. But, quote, if the Negroes hear other Negroes spread the love of God with liberty and power, they are overcome at once, and ignorance and disbelief gives way. So that, just as in Latin America 200 years before, the colonial subjects converted one another to their master's religion. Yet to the slave populations, Christianity was always an incomplete religion. It dispensed no magic medicine. It gave no credence to ancestors. It provided no protection, except prayer, against witchcraft, and was unwilling to afford real equality to the black church leaders it had trained itself, as all higher functions in the church remained whites only. So that in Jamaica, by the 1860s, those black church leaders began to form their own church, that the colonial elite called the Native Baptist Church, and that concerned white missionaries called, quote, the strongest combination of Christianity and heathendom ever invented. Those new churches, on the one hand, held ecstatic worship services full of drumming and dancing, or services in which the believers were cleansed from evil spirits, so that the Native Baptist Church did offer solace against such everyday perils of life as witchcraft, or in which witches were cast down by the evangelists, Bible in hand, or their evil spells bounced back on the holy book. On the other hand, those Native Baptist churches resorted to an increasingly subversive, or as it were, inverted reading of the Old Testament. To them, Christ became black, and the Africans were the Jews in banishment in Babylon, who had to return to their promised land, Africa, following the passage in the book of Isaiah that reads, and it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hands again the second time to recover the remnants of his people from the islands of the sea. The native churches, likely in the aftermath of the Italian defeat by Ethiopian troops at Adowa in 1896, which resounded throughout the world, but particularly resounded in the Caribbean, where it was seen as a symbol of African valor in the face of the European colonial onslaught, fixed the Africans Israel in Ethiopia in the early 20th century. In the 1920s, this faith of the native Baptist churches was reinterpreted by the great Pan-African leader Marcus Garvey to argue that if the whites had a white god, the Negro had to create his own god, a god he was to interpret through the spectacles of Ethiopia. Some of his most enthusiastic followers then set up a new church that they originally called the Hamitic Church, and who perceived Garvey as the apostle of a new Christian religion for Africans. All rejoiced at the coronation of Haile Selassie, Emperor Rastafari, in Ethiopia in 1930. That appeared to confirm an earlier prophecy of an African leader of great power and majesty arising out of Africa as living son of God. While Garvey wrote, "The psalmist prophesied that princes would come out of Egypt, and Ethiopia would stretch forth her hand to God. We have no doubt that this time is now come. Ethiopia is stretching forth her hands. It is for us, the Negro race, to assist in every way to hold up the hand to Emperor Rastafari." So the leaders of the Hamitic Church, that now calls itself the Rastafari Church, Leonard Howell, established an agricultural commune in the Cockburn countries in the 40s, where his movement developed many of the characteristics which still characterize it and with which most listeners will likely be familiar: wearing dreadlocks, long coils of hair, smoking ganja, their special dialect, and their own kind of music. A music that fused in the 60s with jazz and rock and roll to create one of the most powerful and instantly recognizable brands of music of the modern world, reggae music. Now, to return to Victorian society, this image of Victorian society as a great age of faith is one image of the 19th century, and there is more than a grain of truth to it. Yet it might equally well be argued that muscular Christianity proceeded from a pronounced sense of insecurity about the future of religion, much as modern religious fundamentalism is very much a response to a religiously completely indifferent consumer society. A worldwide jihad in the modern world opposes a global megaworld, as Benjamin Barber put it in a classical book. And in the Victorian age, a worldwide muscular Christianity opposed a worldwide mammon worship, as elaborated by that great Victorian sage, Thomas Carrer, who wrote in 1844, quote, "To speak in the ancient dialect, we have forgotten God. There is no longer any God for us. God's laws are become merely the greatest happiness principle, a parliamentary expediency. The heavens overarch us only as an astronomical timekeeper, a butt for Herschel telescopes to shoot science at, to shoot sentimentalities at. Man has lost the soul out of him, and now, after the due period, begins to find the want of it. This is verily the plague spot, center of the universal social gangrene, threatening all modern things with frightful death. for what had replaced quotes. Despite all these mere verbal declarations of intense adherence to the faith, was the worship of money. To further quote Carlyle, "We, for the present, with our mammon gospel, have come to strange conclusions. We call this a society, and call about professing openly the totalist separation and isolation. Our life is not one of mutual helpfulness. Rather, cloaked on the due laws of war, named fair competition, it is a mutual hostility. We have forgotten everywhere that cash payment is not the sole relation of human beings. We think that it absolves and liquidates all engagements of men. My starving workers," answers the rich mill owner, "did I not hire them fairly in the market? Did I not pay them to the last sixpence the sum covenanted for? What have I to do with them? Verily, mammon worship is a melancholy greed." Now, the implications of this substitution of God for mammon in modern society were classically summed up by Friedrich Nietzsche in his book The Gay Science, in a phrase that has become so famous that you may read it scribed onto the walls of public toilets in the West nowadays. And that passage runs as follows. A man is described by Nietzsche as running around with a lantern through a marketplace, shouting, "I see God, I see God." He arouses some amusement. No one takes him seriously. Maybe he took an ocean voyage, lost his way. Much laughter. Frustrated, the madman smashes his lantern on the ground, crying out, "God is dead, and we have killed him, you and I. God is dead, God remains dead, and we have killed him. How shall we comfort ourselves, the murderers of all murderers? What was holiest and mightiest of all, that the world has yet owned, has bled to death under our knives. Who will wipe this blood off us? Must we ourselves not become gods simply to appear worthy of it? But I've come too soon," he immediately realized, as his detractors of a minute before stare at him in astonishment. And he pursues, "This prodigious event is still on its way. It is still wandering. It has not yet reached the ears of men. Lightning and thunder require time. The light of the stars requires time. Deeds, though done, still require time to be seen and heard. This deed is still more distant from them than the most distant stars. And yet this deed, the death of God, they have done themselves." So the great age of faith simultaneously killed God. Nor is this in fact in contradiction with one another. For the passage is easily misunderstood, and Nietzsche later on elaborated on it in his Thus Spoke Zarathustra, where Zarathustra says, quote, "The work of a suffering and tortured God, the world then seemed to me, the dream and the fiction of a God, the world then seemed to me, colored smoke before the eyes of a discontented God. The Creator wished to look away from himself, so he created this world, eternally imperfect, image of an eternal contradiction and imperfect image, a drunken joy to its imperfect Creator. Thus did the world seem to me. Thus did he also once cast my delusion beyond man." Like all the believers in an afterworld, beyond man indeed, are your brothers. That God whom I created was man-made, and madness, like all gods, human was he, and only a poor fragment of a human and an ego. So God, this man-made image, had for Nietzsche to be replaced by a superior human being that no longer was to be a poor fragment of an imaginary God, but a whole human that Nietzsche called the Übermensch. For what Nietzsche above all reproached Christianity with was that it had bred a, what he called, herd mentality amongst its believers. Or, as Zarathustra says, despisers of life are they, decaying and poisoned themselves, of whom the earth is weary. So let them pass away. Once sin against God was the greatest sin, but God died, and with him these sinners. To sin against the earth is now the most terrible sin, and to refer the entrails of the unknowable higher than the meaning of the earth. Now, following Nietzsche's sublime metaphor of the death of God, a God that was merely a poor fragment or a poor image of a human, and yet withheld humans from enjoying life in the here and now, the two founding fathers of modern sociology, Emil Durkheim and Max Weber, elaborated this image of a forgotten, or even of a dead God, though his death was as yet unbeknown to the mass of believers, into a general theory of a process they called secularization. Weber and Durkheim did not argue, as the many critics of the theory habitually assert, that swept aside by the irresistible force of modernity, organized religion was dead already or on the way of dying in the modern world, just like Nietzsche did not claim the Persian God was dead already, as all those writing that slogan on a public toilet probably assume. Rather, Weber argued something far more subtle. He argued that religious observations or rituals played an increasingly minor part in everyday life, while the belief in spells, ghosts or spirits had entirely died out in modern European cities beyond the Basilicata countryside, to recall an earlier lecture. Yet religion is always closely tied in with both a sense of magic and of the miraculous. In that sense, it has largely died out in the modern world. Weber called this the disenchantment of everyday life, and it is indeed typified by Levi's utter sense of befuddlement at the beliefs of the peasants in the Basilicata. Did they really believe in witches and werewolves? Yet, essentially, these peasants believed as much in an ever-present, all-encompassing netherworld as the Jamaicans in the 19th century did, for whom Methodism or baptism was too rational a religion, as it tried to cast their entire belief in spells and spirit into doubt as barbaric superstition, and thus allowed them no protection against these spells or spirits, since to Jamaican peasants they were not only real, but their dangers were omnipresent as well, while the white church there reasons from a disenchanted world, in which the netherworld is either distant or located only in the afterlife. And as it lost this sense of a direct tie to an omnipresent netherworld, religion became just a set of rituals that served to affirm and reinforce group solidarity. For to Durkheim, religion was a form of group solidarity. It shaped a balanced and cohesive community. It protected individuals from a sense of alienation from their community, and it maximized the individual's potential for happiness. Thus it ensured social stability and cohesion. Yet those religious forms of solidarity embodied in the churches, or for that matter in the guilds, which had commonly a saint as a patron that the guild members worshipped together, that form of solidarity had been shattered by the increasing individualism of modern societies, where, in Durkheim's terminology, a mechanic solidarity, in which there was a high degree of collective solidarity and conformity, had given way to an organic solidarity, in which there was a low degree of collective solidarity and of conformity. He linked this to the increasingly intricate division of labor, and it might be linked to Carlyle's mutual hostility of the free marketplace as well. And it was linked to, and perhaps first and foremost, to mass migration to the cities. It is much easier to have a strong degree of social cohesiveness in a small village than it is in the huge megacities that arose in the 19th century. By 1844, Benjamin Disraeli could already speak of the sense of melancholy, even uneasiness, that attends our entrance into a great city. Is it that the sense of all this vast experience with which we have no connection, a place where we are utterly unknown, oppresses us with our insignificance? And if, speaking about the fast living in the big city, Disraeli was then talking about Manchester or about megacity London, and the biggest city in the world, by 1890, one might as well be speaking about Vienna, about Barcelona, about New York, or about Berlin. Now, obviously, one way for migrants to the city to recover that sense of community is to become a member of the church. Yet there is a major difference. In a small village, one is a member of the church because one lives in that village. Not going to church would make one a social outcast. Yet in an anonymous city, one becomes a member of a church as a matter of individual choice or individual preference. And most people herded into those new big cities simply neglected to make that choice. Thus, in the first and only census ever made in England of religious attendance in 1851, the result turned out to be that the majority, 51% of the population of England, did not regularly attend church, and the attendance was lowest in the city, where nearly 15% of the population attended church. Attendance was lowest in the established churches and higher in the Baptist, Quaker, or Methodist congregations, and women attended church more regularly than did men. And older women did so very much in particular, a pattern attested in virtually any religious survey since, for which I will not venture on an explanation. And attendance was lowest again amongst the urban working class, who were simply too tired or too preoccupied on how to pay the rent on Sunday that they wanted to waste their time sitting in a church. For that secularization thesis, Durkheim adduced four cases in point. First, modern states feel no particular need to associate with any particular form of Christianity, indeed, commonly with no peculiar form of organized religion at all. Durkheim was arguing as a Frenchman from a country where the state particularly valued itself on its laïcité. Yet it is doubtful whether the constant invocation of God coupled to the flock in the late 19th century was anything more than just another refrain of nationalism. As we saw with Gordon, the British then called upon just about any congregation possible to sanctify the cause of the British Empire. Second, modern religion allows itself to become subject to the kind of scientific research in the Bible, which, even as late as the age of Spinoza, the church would have deemed entirely anathema. As said, the writings of Spinoza, in which he showed the many textual discrepancies in the Old Testament, were outlawed in the 17th century. Yet no state, barring perhaps Saudi Arabia and Iran, would dream to outlaw critical scientific writings on the authenticity of the Bible or the Quran nowadays. Since the 9th century, the Catholic Church has used the so-called Index Librorum Prohibitorum, on which, over the course of time, virtually any major Western thinker has featured, books which the Vatican deems heretical or lascivious. Yet, without any assistance of the government in the 19th century, writers began in due course to pride themselves being on the Index. It was, for example, a major sales pitch for the, in retrospect, boring, bombastic poetry of Italian poet Gabriele D'Annunzio, who seems to have written especially to outrage the Church so as to attain higher sales. And as the Vatican was unable to enforce the Index anyway, it was quietly dropped in 1966. Third, religious institutions are unable to enforce rules relating to sacrilege, or, at least, such rules are rarely enforced by states, however much the Church would have liked it. Unlike in the 17th century, when, as I said, cursing the name of God could get you condemned to prison by the Inquisition. Fourthly, the Church has only limited authority over individual lives. Thus, for example, in earlier periods, people were withheld from committing suicide by the belief this was a severe sin, while suicide was, around 1900, seen as a purely individual decision. Fifthly, and most importantly, the intellectually most advanced section of the population, employed at universities, in their everyday practice stick to scientific rules. Thus, for example, no historian, however much they might frequent the church, or for that matter, even if he's a Jesuit, would seriously explain something by the intention of God nowadays. To put it bluntly, by the mid-19th century, figuring out the intention of God had been exiled to the theology faculties, and often it cannot even be found there. Thus, to be sure, while to the overwhelming majority of mankind, religion was still the preeminent form of public and private thought, amongst the intellectual vanguard, science had gradually replaced religion. Yet, this pulled not only its entire position as an intellectually dominant, or at least respectable force into question, but its teachings were increasingly questioned by the best and the brightest as well. Now, doubting one's religion, which might occasionally ensue in the utterly horrendous experience of losing one's religion, was in the 19th century still a very profound existential crisis, rather than the rather humdrum individual decision it is nowadays, where you may choose to quit religion in the same way as you do smoking. In the 19th century, it was a very major life-shaping decision, as losing one's religion meant severing any ties with the cherished beliefs of one's childhood and, certainly for the upper classes, shaped by the muscular Christianity with one's entire community. So that, as historian Margaret Mason observes, never has any age in history produced such a detailed literature of lost faith. And yet, as the protagonist in William Froude's 1855 novel Nemesis of Faith acknowledges, and that is worth a long quote, as it well illustrates the causes for the death of God in the West, quote, I suppose most people would allow they found some difficulties, at any rate, with the Old Testament. Yet I find insuperable ones. To believe, for instance, that God worked miracles to plague a nation for its ruler's sins, or to make their lives intolerable. But why do they must say, because it is in the Bible? Yes, here it is. Other books we may sit in judgment on, but not on the Bible. And we are to believe whatever is in there, no matter how monstrous, on the authority of God. He has told us, and that is enough. But how do we know he has told us? The Church says so. Why did the Church say so? Because the Jews said so. And how do we know the Jews could not be mistaken, because the Jews said they were God's people, and God guided them. One would have thought, if this were so, he would have guided them in interpreting their books too. And we ought all to be Jews now. But what is the history of those books, which we call the Old Testament? No one knows who the authors were, or even at what date they were written. All we can make out is that in the later and fallen age of the Jews, when their imaginative greatness had forsaken them, and their high enthusiastic faith and passionate devotion to God had dwindled down into intolerant arrogance and barren fanaticism, wishing to console themselves for their present degradation by the glories of their past, they made a collection out of the wreck of their old literature. That whole was then cast together in one great mold, where, of course, God was the founder, and then, behold, the one complete, entire revelation of the Almighty, composed, compiled, and finished by himself. Were ever such huge pretensions hung upon so slight a thread? Thus, because, as I said in an earlier lecture, the study of religion has become the special domain of divinity departments, who perceive humans as homo religiosus, and thus like always to proclaim that secularization is dead, the four common arguments against the theory do not really wash. First, the theory did not deny religion was bound to play an important role in public life into the foreseeable future, and even in the distant future, since it was not only a powerful traditional way of enforcing solidarity, but still commanded considerable authority here on earth as well. In 1900, there were, after all, some 40,000 men of the church in England against less than 1,000 scientists. He did second not argue the number of people saying they thought there might be some God was in decline. The argument rather asserts that while people may still have some fake notion about a God, this does not guide them in life any longer. Thus, a personal commitment to God was gradually replaced over the course of the 19th and 20th centuries by a performance of religious duties. Life was separated in a sacred compartment to be observed on Sunday morning and the profane rest of the week. As historian Manning Clark sums up the trend in Australia, and far from only in Australia, the believers, as the clergy encouraged them to take care of their earthly welfare, encouraged the belief as well that the heavens held up by the priests could safely be left to the angels and the sparrows, and that man's concern was with the here and now. Third, the theory did not assert that scientists might not be regular churchgoers. It merely asserted that they did not use explanations by God in their profession any longer. And finally, and above all, secularization theory did not make an argument about the non-West, that Christianity was advancing in peasant societies in Africa in Durkheim's age, would to Durkheim have proven nothing at all, as it was an argument about advanced capitalist societies in the West, and organic solidarity was probably much more alive amongst, say, peasants in a village in Igboland than it was amongst steelworkers in Saint-Étienne. Looked upon in a very long-term perspective, then, it appears really to me to be very premature to speak about the late secularization theory, as many sociologists, and of course even more people employed by religious studies departments now commonly do, since, after all, to recall the previous discussion, in explaining the supposed death of secularization theory, they will neither refer to the will of God, nor would they argue their opponents should be handed over to a Sharia court or to the Inquisition. As Durkheim had predicted, in modern society, religion is by and large seen as a private matter. For one of the supposed greatest achievements of the modern state of law, the freedom of religion, makes religion a matter of individual preference or choice, where you are completely free to decide whether you want to become Muslim, a member of Scientology, believe in goblins, or whatever you like. Now, while Western governments see religious freedom as a fundamental human right, in most religious tradition, freedom of religion is an abomination. Since if you can follow whatever religious view you like, you not only condemn yourself to eternal damnation, but try to cast others into eternal hellfire as well, so that both the community and government have a duty to forestall this. Thus, for example, while there were a few cases of religious persecutions of one of the new religions that arose in the 19th century, namely the Church of the Latter-day Saints, or Mormons, in the American West in the 30s or 40s, by what is generally called mobs in the literature. But then surely the Wild West was no paradise of non-violence. They were condemned by the US government. And those persecutions of the Mormons, of whom only a few dozens were killed, surely pale in comparison with the ferocious persecutions of another new faith that arose in the second half of the 19th century, namely the followers of Sayyid Ali Muhammad and then Mirza Ula Ali, who became known as the Baha'i in Iran. Perhaps 20,000 followers of the Baha'i were condemned to death by the Iranian state in the most horrendous ways or killed by furious mobs. For while the clergy had initially hesitated to term the views of Sayyid Ali Muhammad, the founder of the Baha'i, as heresy, for that is a very weighty accusation that may not be admitted if the accused stays within the boundaries of the Islamic tradition, so that Sayyid Ali Muhammad was executed as a rebel, his successor, Mirza Ula, then claimed he had received an entirely new revelation, incompatible with Islam, and he began to convert the people to it too. So the legal scholars had little choice but to term all of this apostasy, and they called upon the worldly authorities to stamp it out. For unlike in European states, in Qajar, Iran, it was still the responsibility of the state to protect its population against heresy. Of course, in the one state which still does not recognize religious freedom and follows the old view, religious freedom is an abomination, contemporary Saudi Arabia, conversion of a Muslim to another religion is considered apostasy and is a crime that is punishable by death if the accused does not recant, for which the Saudi state maintains a special religious police. Now, if one reason for secularization was, as I said in an earlier lecture already, the separation of church and state, the other one was the impenetration of science into everyday life and the exile of God from scientific explanation. That was a divergence that was marked by Kant's critique of pure reason, where Kant argued or established that scientific and logic method could not supply evidence either for or against the existence of God, so that Kant summed up his results in the critique as, "No one, no doubt, will be able to boast again that he knows that there is a God and a future life." Yet he still went on, "My conviction in God, that the belief in a God and in another world, is so interwoven with my moral sentiment, that as that is so, there is little danger of my losing the latter, so I feel I shall never be deprived of the former." To sum up Kant's view, somewhat irrelevantly, if there was no God, he ought to be invented for society to stick together and in order that the social inferiors would remain obedient to their betters. For Kant was a man of the Enlightenment, but very much a man of the conservative era. Now, the first step to this exile of God from scientific explanation was the Newtonian physics of the 17th century, in which physical nature, though Newton admittedly had tried to demonstrate that, as he said, this most beautiful system of the sun, planets and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being, still obeyed its own proper set of mathematical rules, without having to invoke divine intervention any longer. God became, in a popular image in the 18th century, the great watchmaker of the universe, who had set that whole cosmic contraption in motion, and then retired. The second step were the advances in the field of geology in the late 18th and early 19th century, where, rather than the fanciful dating on the biblical genealogy of Adam that had so far put the date of creation at 4,000 or 7,000 years ago, the Comte de Buffon argued in the late 18th century that the Earth was at least 75,000 years old. Furthermore, by the 1820s, geologists also abandoned the old idea there was any evidence for a biblical flood that had supposedly once covered all of Earth. There was, in other words, no scientific proof at all the world had been created by God in the way the Bible described it, whereas scientific logic could not supply any argument for the existence of God any longer either. To believe in God was henceforth a leap of faith rather than a reasoned decision, as the Danish theologian Søren Kierkegaard classically put it, unlike in the Middle Ages, when the existence of the Christian God was held to be the only rational scientific explanation of the universe. Yet since, after all, the physics of the Bible occupy merely a few passages, whereas the idea of human creation by God is central to the Bible, and indeed to Semitic salvation religions at large, as Jesus was sent to redeem the sins of Adam, unlike to Hinduism, which does not proceed from the idea that humans are created in the image of God, whereas the entire matter is completely irrelevant to Chinese Taoism. The greatest blow to organized Western religion from science was dealt by, no doubt, the greatest scientist of the 19th century, Charles Darwin, who in his autobiography described his religious beliefs as follows, since he boarded the ship HMS Beagle. Worth a long quote here, since there is an entire literature arguing that Darwin was either Christian or a closet Christian, whose Christianity was always struggling to come out, but never quite did. Quote, whilst on board the Beagle, I was quite orthodox, but I had gradually come by this time to see that the Old Testament, from its manifestly false history of the world, with the Tower of Babel, the rainbow as a sign, and so on, and from its attributing to God the feelings of a revengeful tyrant, was no more to be trusted than the sacred books of the Hindus or any belief of any barbarian. The question then continuously rose before my mind and would not be banished. Is it credible that if God were now to make a revelation to the Hindus, would he permit it to be connected with the belief in Vishnu, Shiva, and so on, as Christianity is connected by the Old Testament? This appeared to me utterly incredible. By further reflecting that the clearest evidence would be requisite to make any sane man believe in the miracles by which Christianity is supported, that the men at the time of the Bible were ignorant and credulous to a degree almost incomprehensible to us, that the Gospels cannot be proven to have been written simultaneously with the events, that they differ in many important details, far too important as seem to me to be admitted as the usual inaccuracy of eyewitnesses. By such reflections as these, I gradually came to disbelieve in Christianity. The fact that many false religions have spread over large portions of the earth had some weight with me. Beautiful as is the morality of the New Testament, it cannot be denied that its perfection depends in part on the interpretation which we now put on metaphors and allegories. I can indeed now hardly see how anyone ought to wish Christianity to be true, for if so, the plain language of the text seems to show that the men who do not believe, and this would include my father, brother, and almost all my friends, will be everlastingly punished, and this is a damnable doctrine. Darwin, on the urgings of his very devout wife Emma, who was deeply disturbed by what she called his increasing leaning towards materialism, long hesitated whether to publish his findings. Yet, in 1858, news that Alfred Russel Wallace was now planning to publish a very similar theory forced an early publication of Darwin's theory in a book he called The Origins of Species by Natural Selection. And wrote Darwin about that book, the argument for design in nature, which formerly seemed to be so conclusive, fails now that the law of natural selection has been discovered. We can no longer argue that, for instance, the beautiful hinge of a bivalve shell must have been made by some intelligent being, like the hinge of a door is made by a man. There seems to be no more design in the variability of organic beings and in the action of natural selection than in the course the wind blows. Whilst natural selection, on the one hand, somewhat alleviated the eternal issue of the theodicy, that is the reason for the existence of evil and cruelty in the world, as not being due to any personal fault of the believer, as rather to impersonal forces, Darwin's theory still cast humans in a cold, soulless world, in which there was no personal, loving creator God anymore, as rather a natural process that was as indifferent to humans as the direction of the wind is, whence many, if not most people, found the theory of natural selection emotionally hard or indeed impossible to accept. Or, as Alfred Lord Tennyson put it, "Oh yet, we trust that somehow good will be the final call of ill, to pangs of nature, sins of will, defects of doubts, and taint of blood, that nothing walks with aimless feet, that not one life shall be destroyed, or cast as rubbish to the void, when God has made the pile complete, that not a worm is cloven in vain, that not a moth with vain desire is shriveled in a fruitless fire, or but subserves another game." Yet Tennyson optimistically concluded on the theory of evolution: "Our little systems have their day. They have their day and cease to be. They are but broken lights of thee, and thou, O Lord, art more than they. We have but faith we cannot know, for knowledge is of things we see, and yet we trust it comes from thee." And thus, wrote Darwin's closest confidant and professor of sociology in London, Thomas Huxley, on the reception of The Origins of Species, "overflowing the narrow bounds of purely scientific circles, the species question occupies the attention of general society. Everybody has read Mr. Darwin's book, or at least has given opinion upon its merits or demerits. Pietists, whether lay ecclesiastic, decry it with mild railing, which sounds so charitable. Bicots denounce it with ignorant invective. Old ladies of both sexes consider it a decidedly dangerous book, and even so far, who have no better mud to throw quote, antiquated writers to show that its author is no better than an ape. Yet then, wrote Huxley later on, quote, who shall number the patient and earnest seekers after the truth whose life has been embittered and their good name blasted by the mistaken zeal of Bible idolaters. Yet it is true that if philosophers have suffered, their cause has always been amply avenged. Extinguished theologians lie about the cradle of creation of every science as the strangled snakes lay beside that of Hercules. And history records that whenever science and orthodoxy have been fairly opposed, the latter has been forced to retire from the list, bleeding and crushed, if not annihilated. But orthodoxy is the Bourbon of the world of thought. It learns not, neither can it forget, and though at present bewildered and afraid to move, it is as willing as ever to insist that the first chapter of Genesis contains the beginning and the end of sound science, and to visit with thunderbolts those who refuse to degrade nature to the level of primitive Judaism. And this is obviously still the case today. But then, as Darwin had also said, quote, we should not overlook the probability of the constant inculcation in a belief of God on the minds of children, which produces so strong and perhaps even inherited effect on their brains not yet fully developed, that it would be as difficult for them to throw off their belief in God as it is for a monkey to throw off its instinctive fear and hatred of a snake. Now, there were basically three ways the church reacted to this challenge posed by science. The first way, which was to some extent the line chosen by the Anglican Church and the Baptist Church, was to argue that whereas part of the Bible was perhaps not to be read as a literal statement of facts, it still contained a deeper and more profound truth that was, as it were, not contaminated by seeing it as a metaphor. In the matter preached by Thomas Hedlund in 1879, for example, thank God that the scientific men have shattered the idol of an infallible book, for so they helped reveal Jesus Christ in all his majesty. He, we say, is the Word of God. He is inspiring you. He is the wisdom of science. And it gives us far grander notions to think making the world by his spirit through the ages than in a few days. Yet the problem with this mainstream metaphorical reading of the Bible is, of course, where to stop. For, on the one hand, if you are claiming parts of the Bible are mere metaphors, what withholds you from claiming the whole Bible is a metaphor? Yet, is it not extremely arrogant for us humans to claim we can define the truth in his word and his eternal wisdom? God, after all, surpasses us mere humans in knowledge, and only he knows what intention he has with the universe. The second way to rise to this challenge, and that was the official line of the Catholic Church, was basically to argue that the Church is primarily a ritual community, and that, therefore, salvation can only come from the teachings of the Church, irrespective of what modern science may teach or believe. Or, as Pope Leo XIII argued in his encyclical book Aeterni Patris from 1879, quote, in the tempest that is upon us, when the Christian faith is being constantly assailed by machinations and crafts of a certain false wisdom, all youth, but especially those who are the growing hope of the Church, should be nourished on the strong and robust food of doctrine, that so, mighty in strength, and armed at all points, they may become habituated to advance the cause of religion with force and with judgment, and that they may be able to exhort in sound doctrine and to convince the gainsayers. Many of those who, with minds alienated from their faith, hate Catholic institutions, claim reason as their sole mistress and guide. Now we think that, apart from the supernatural help of God, nothing is better calculated to heal those minds and to bring them into favor with the Catholic faith than the solid doctrine of the Father Scholastics, who so clearly and forcibly demonstrated the firm foundation of the faith, its divine origin, its certain truth, the arguments that sustain it, and the benefits it has conferred on the human race, as well as its perfect accord with reason. Domestic and civil society even, which, as all see, is exposed to danger from this plague of perversive opinions, would certainly enjoy a far more peaceful and secure existence if a more wholesome doctrine were taught in universities and high schools, so that henceforth the theology taught in Catholic universities was to be strictly that of Thomas More Aquinas, so that it might strengthen the unity of the Church. However, the problem with all that was that it put the Catholic religion, while no doubt remaining the one immutable thing in a universe of constant mutation, as its apologists said, entirely out of the mainstream of modern thought. So that in the late 19th century, there was a trend to found special pontifical, Jesuit or Catholic universities in Europe, South America, and the USA to train students in a medieval scholastic thought that was not taught at other universities. A thought alone that would guard them from all the excesses of the modern times and the modern sciences. Though obviously few Catholics or universities really considered teaching Catholic physics or chemistry, so that on your average Catholic university, if you opened the doors to the science department, you were in the modern age. Once you opened that of the divinity department, you were in the middle age, where so-called neo-Thomist orthodoxy reigned. The third way out was simply to deny modern science altogether. Darwin's theory, just as all our broken systems, would wither, while the biblical truth is eternal and the grace of the Lord is evident in the working of nature around us, and as apparent as the godly love we will daily experience if we but devote our lives to Jesus Christ. So, as Dutch theologian and politician Abraham Kuyper in the beginning of the 20th century underlined, Darwinism was evil. And against that entire system proposed by science, that of an aimless and purposeless universe, the true Protestant Christians should no longer cede any ground. They should cast any textbook containing that supposed scientific dogma aside. If liberal education wanted to teach it, let them, in Kuyper's view, be allowed to do so. But then the Christians should be allowed to build their own educational establishment. Indeed, since all the spheres of Protestant life are in the face of God, the Protestants should establish their own art guilds, their own anti-revolutionary political party, their own university, not paid by the Dutch state, and so on, up to their own Calvinist shops or Protestant pigeon fanciers. So that, ideally, a God-fearing Calvinist would not encounter anybody but God-fearing Calvinists all his life, an idea that in Dutch is called verzuiling and is somewhat vaguely translated in English as pillarization. Yet those zealous Protestants also thought that as they were retreating from the rest of Dutch society, their very isolation would also give them strength. Verzuiling was intended as a rallying cry for the shattered forces of Dutch Calvinism, for the mission ahead to win the Dutch people back to Calvinism. However, the problem for those Calvinists was that as they then attained the political power they sought for, they had inevitably to compromise with the liberal or the Catholic parties and worldviews, and thus had to dilute their own teachings to make such compromises. All this meant that the whole project was in the longer run always unattainable, so that the Protestant bloc already began to shatter in the mainstream anti-revolutionary party and the Christian historical party in the first decade of the 20th century, as the Christian historical party accused the anti-revolutionary party of being not precise enough in matters of the faith. The Christians would reject forever any compromise, and thus they effectively condemned themselves to become and remain forever a mere splinter party representing a few ultra-orthodox Calvinist villages in the Faroe region. In the USA, in the 1920s, a very similar split occurred between what was called the modernizing Protestant Church, which reached the Bible as a metaphor, and thus to the Orthodox was steadily yielding more ground to evil Darwinism, and the fundamentalist Church, who not merely argued that to think you know better than God is arrogance, but also feared, or of course hoped, that the second coming of Christ would be presaged by preachers preaching false doctrines in the church, and that only those who opposed that evil would be saved. As often, this fundamentalist-modernist split was partly a regional one. The modernists tended to be typically strongest in the northern cities, while the fundamentalists were typically found in the rural south. Yet it was a political split as well. The really unifying factor in the various fundamentalist churches was a preponderance of political conservatism. They were against welfare programs, more rights for African Americans, and of course opposed the communist Satan. And they of course exalted that, quote, "Every one of the 400 largest corporations of America are led by Christians. No great business success was ever attained by a corporation whose founder lacked the faith of God." Such kind of flattery the corporate CEOs were only too glad to receive, so that the fundamentalists, while mainly a movement of poor southern farmers, from the outset could count on ample financial support from the big corporations. Now, in the 30s to early 60s, dominated by the New Deal consensus, it was generally supposed by the modernists that the fundamentalists dwindled away. But by the late 60s, they re-emerged again from their isolation to now start with their mission of converting America. For, as Kuyper had prescribed to the Dutch Protestants, they had meanwhile been strengthened in their very isolation and had built up an entire infrastructure. Youth organizations, universities, such as Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, charities, and so on. Like a Dutch one in the early 20th century, a modern American fundamentalist can spend his entire life meeting only other fundamentalists. Above all, however, with the corporate money of media tycoon William Randolph Hearst, the fundamentalists had acquired both radio and TV stations, and that made them, by the 70s, to the worldwide most visible branch of American Christianity, and, given their conservative and anti-communist leanings, coupled to their influence in the media, that made them particularly attractive to such Republican Party worthies as Dwight Eisenhower or Richard Nixon, who both tried currying their favors, although neither of them were very fervent Christians. Given all that powerful corporate and political backing, fundamentalism has meanwhile increasingly turned to the mainstream of American religion. It has a near stranglehold on the Republican Party and is the mainstream of American missions abroad too, as for example in Guatemala, where in the 80s General Efraín Ríos Montt, recently condemned in court for genocide, and an ardent church-going Pentecostal, announced that he would cleanse the world of the Antichrist, communism, so that he was thrice honored by a visit of America's leading televangelist, Pat Robertson, who assured him that, quote, "the prayers of tens of thousands evangelicals across America would be with him." Now, completely overlooking this prominent presence of those fundamentalist Christians in American politics, it is then common for Western media or politicians to wonder why Islam does not understand us in the West, or why Islam is so hostile to us. Well, let me offer a hint to an answer. May that not be, since we, and the USA in particular, are not only the whole time stressing we are Christians, but also because we insist that any government, under the cover of freedom of religion, should forthwith let militantly Christian American missionaries in to spread the word. In 2010, there were approximately 127,000 American missionaries active worldwide, with a budget from collections in the USA alone that is twice the entire budget of US aid. We, in other words, are still clearly as much intent on obliterating the erroneous way of Islam as we were in 1898, then as now, not so much in words as rather in deeds. So that, for example, immediately on the American conquest of Iraq, quoting a news magazine, the Southern Baptist Convention, the largest American Protestant denomination, announced that its International Mission Board would now send volunteers to distribute food and shelter and help the Iraqis have true freedom in Jesus Christ. Though obviously Iraq became so dangerous afterwards, no missionaries dared venture there. It might still seem to those Iraqis as if the GIs too came to give the Muslims the gospel, and only then they would call the bargain fair.